All right, so I want to introduce Nikki, the main speaker here.
There's two speakers.
Well, there's two speakers. I don't even know. We'll see it later. Yeah. I'm an addict. My name is Nikki. Hey. Now, can you guys hear me like this so I don't have to hold on? Okay, great. Okay, the topic of today's workshop is the 8th and 9th step, cleaning up the wreckage. First thing I'd like to do is thank the committee, and this is just for me, my experience with conventions is the very first time I was asked to do a convention was at the World Convention in Honolulu, Hawaii, and it ruined my vacation. I went with my sponsor, and she was on the World Service Committee, and I had 5 years clean. And at the time, workshop speakers in their literature had to have 10 years clean. And they had voted that down to get more ethnicity and more diversity into the World Convention to 5 years. So as soon as they did that, my sponsor was on the World Service Board at the time. She was like, oh my God, you have to, you know, let my sponsee chair the meeting. Unbeknownst to me, of course. But her and I were going there for a, you know, like a, to get back together and bond and all that kind of stuff for a week or 10 days. And the meeting was on a Saturday, and I arrived in Hawaii on a Monday, so by the time Saturday got, you know, rolled around, I was like sick to my stomach, and you know, and it was in the Honolulu Convention Center, and it did kind of look like this with all these chairs, except it was full of people, yeah. So this is a little weird. I'm just going to be honest and talk about my, you know, my sponsors have always taught me to talk about my fears and my feelings. And one of the things about this room that is strange is there's a lot of chairs and there's not a lot of people. So it just makes a weird vibe, you know. But I have a lot of people in this room that love me, so I'm just going to shoot from the hip and do this thing. I want to thank the committee for seeing something in me that sometimes I still don't see in myself, even after 21 years. If you don't hear anything else in this meeting, please hear that my experience with the 8th and 9th step is if you don't clean up the wreckage of the past, you will not reap the rewards of the present or the future. And it's not just my personal experience, it is the experience of sitting in the room, continuing to go to meetings, and watching people walk in circles. And I will walk up to those people or sponsees or friends, and I will say to them, what step are you on? Where are you at in your recovery? And most times, they have not worked the 8th and 9th step. They have not cleaned up the wreckage of their past. And they're chasing their tail, you know, like starting businesses and buying things and doing things, but not sharing them and not giving back what was freely given to them and not being generous and not having spiritual principles. And like, I'll watch this and see, like, that's why I still go to meetings with 21 years clean. I need to see the things, what not to do as well, you know? And like, I'm not saying like it's a portion of people or this person or that person, but it is my experience. And I've watched it happen countless times. So the first thing that I wanted to read is out of the 9th step in our basic text, which I read the whole basic text last night. I couldn't sleep, so I read the whole basic text. The very first sentence in the 9th step, we may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, says this step should not be avoided. If we do, we are reserving a place in our program for relapse. That doesn't say might, could. It's kind of like a finality statement. Like, you're reserving a place in your program for relapse. It should not be avoided. Now, another thing about step meetings is you have to be spiritually fit enough to see the pain you cause others before you can write a list of persons that you have harmed and society and the people around you. And like I had a list of social workers, teachers, you know, drug rehabs, family members, you know, it was just like, there was a time in my first sponsorship relationship that she told me I owed an amends to every person I ever came in contact with in my act of addiction. So the spiritual fitness comes from the previous seven. So it's kind of hard to just walk in here and talk about a list without allowing you to understand the spiritual fitness that comes with being able to make amends to those people that have harmed you without thinking about the harm they caused you. Because that's the hit. I must rid myself of the resentment in the fourth step and own my shit and understand that there was a time in my life where I knew right from wrong and I continued to do wrong regardless of the consequences. I don't care if I was 13 years old, a month before my 13th birthday, I put my arm out and said, hit me. It was not my mother's fault that I continued to do wrong regardless of the consequences. And who am I not to forgive her when she was the addict that I am? I am my mother's daughter. Who am I not to forgive her for my childhood if I expect forgiveness from her and from the world around me in the ninth step? I must be spiritually fit enough to make amends to those people without thinking about the harm they caused me. Sounds simple. So, when I was a little girl, I lived on a hill. I was born in 1972, so you're talking about the early 70s. We got to set this up so you get a visual, right? White rancher, built-in swimming pool. My mother and father owned a beauty salon and a barbershop. They were in one building in Pikesville, Maryland. The 70s were like, the disco, the wigs and the blue hair, and like, it's kind of all coming back right now, actually. My mother was in like shows and stuff, like she was the lady to go to get your hair and makeup done in Pikesville, and my dad was a barber, he had his shop upstairs. They had matching Datsun B210s, two baby girls, 1 year apart, Planned Parenthood, like they made money, bought a house, and then had children. You know what I mean? I don't know where the hell that ever went to either. And I never forget this. It was like one of those memories that's just burned in your brain. My father came upstairs in the kitchen, or we were watching the Gong Show. That'll date me a little bit. And my dad hollered down the steps. He said, "You girls come upstairs. I need to tell you something. Me and your mother have something to tell you, and it's very important." And I walked up the steps, and that day in nursery school, I had learned that to give someone your undivided attention. And so my dad said it was important. So I sat at the round table with the yellow leather chairs and put my hands like this, and I sat at the table and looking at him intently, like, because it was important. And my father said that your mother has asked me to leave. And, to this day, I feel that, man. I don't know why, man. That is so deep inside of me, because before that moment, I had the picture-perfect little life. Like, my mom was an extremist. My dad, they worked together. We had, things were cool, but Christmas time at my house was the most amazing thing, and it's the best memory that I have as a child. My mother was an extremist, and she had seven Christmas trees in the house, and even the pool was decorated out back, and there was just, trails of gifts all through the house, and she was just wild with the Christmas thing. And when she asked my father to leave, unbeknownst to me as a 5 or 4 year old child or whatever, it was like I was 4 or 5 when it happened, I felt hate for the very first time. And I remember the rage filling up in my heart. and it was to my mother. Like, I always loved my dad, but at that moment, I hated my mother. Now, he left, and for like 4 years, my mother was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was sober in AA. And then after my dad left, and my mother relapsed, shit got crazy in my household. And from the fairy tale life of the Christmas trees to having everything that we ever wanted and just a great, you know, morals too. Like, it wasn't just about the physical things. It was about, you know, the love and the trips and the, like, my mother was a hugger and, a, you know, that kind of stuff. 8 years old, I remember I picked up a bottle of vodka, and my mother used to cut herself, like she was a cutter, and she would bleed all over the house and tell my sister and I that it was her, that it was our fault. So I picked up this bottle of vodka, Smirnoff vodka, at 8 years old, and I said, I understand that my mother does not remember what she does. And she would wake up with blood all over her, like on her chest and her arms, because she would like cut here for some reason. And I said, if I drink from the same bottle mommy drinks from, maybe I won't remember what she does either. And you know, 21 years clean and having had sponsees and hearing stories and like the very first time I picked up the drug was to forget. It wasn't about peer pressure or hanging out or, it was to forget the world around me. So I was doomed from the very start, you know? And like, to speed this up a little bit, from 8 years old to 1 month before my 13th birthday, our house became the party house. My mother discovered that we were drinking her bottle and not pouring it out, and she allowed us to drink with her. And shit went from alcohol to marijuana to Quaaludes to PCP to LSD. Like, by the time I was 12 years old, like today when I look at my nieces and my nephews and my sponsees' children and my grandchildren, because I don't have kids, but my husband has kids and they had kids, and so I'm a grandmother and not a mother. It's kind of weird, but I'm like, where the fuck was everybody? You know? And then 1 month before my 13th birthday, hitchhiking back from a 5150 concert in Van Halen in Largo, Maryland, I smoked some Love Boat and I wound up in Village of Tall Trees with a needle in my arm. Like, I was 12 years old. You know, and there's, I still wonder where the fuck was everybody. You know, I still, it wasn't until I worked the 8-step for the third time was I able to make amends to myself of what I robbed myself of as a child. You know, because I was a majorette and I was a pom-pom girl and I was an avid diver and I was a swimmer and I had dreams and aspirations and goals that, you know, they say that, you know, lost dreams awaken in Narcotics Anonymous, but some shit just is gone forever. Let's be real. There's some things that that little girl inside of me will never have. Those dreams are gone, you know? So 1 month before my 13th birthday, I did the cocaine, and from that point to March 26th of the year 2000 is consequences. It's nothing but consequences. And in those years, I blamed my mother for everything. From Waxters to Montrose to MCIW to 9 treatment centers to 3 psych wards, to 4 prison sentences, to 25 arrests. Like, I don't even know when the fuck I got high sometimes, because I've been locked up so many times in 2 different states. And March 26th, the year 2000, I wake up in Johns Hopkins Hospital with no visible veins on my body, 100 pounds soaking wet. And I remember laying on that concrete floor, and there was a freight train running through my brain. And all I could think about was the people that I had hurt. And I don't know why God allowed me that selfless thought at that time laying on that concrete floor. But the freight train, it was my dad and teachers and social workers and my mom and just everything, my grandmother. And I looked up in the sky and I said, God, if my only purpose is to hurt people, I don't want to live here anymore. And it wasn't like a flash of lightning and all that craziness. You know, it was just a spark in my heart because I had been to Narcotics Anonymous. I was introduced to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, my first treatment center, when I was 14 years old, OD'd in my grandmother's bathtub in Washington, D.C., at the Gateway Center, and they gave me this book, they gave me this basic text, and they told me there was another way. And they told me to work the steps, they told me to get a home group, they told me to get a sponsor, and I said, I'm not done, I'm wild as the wind, I'm going to continue to get high. But I was given this gift. And that spark in my heart ignited into a flame that in these last 21 years, I have just never stopped. So, the point of the whole forgiveness piece is I blame my mother for everything I was. The steps in Narcotics Anonymous preach ridding ourselves of the resentments and owning our part. Right? In the first step, I accept the fact that I have the disease of addiction. In accepting the fact that I have the disease of addiction, I must accept the fact that my mother has the disease of addiction. Because she did the best she could with what she had. Now, was she a great mother? No. But in the eighth and ninth step, when I want her to forgive me and the world around me to forgive me for the shit that I did to them, who am I not to forgive her and own my part? And like I said in the beginning, there was a time in my life where I knew right from wrong, and I continue to do wrong regardless of the consequences. All those hospitals, institutions, psychiatrists, hypnotherapists, they all told me it was her fault. Like when I did a psychosocial assessment and told them the story, they were like, well, it is your mother's fault. Well, that just kept me locked and loaded in my brain for longer. Or they said it's her fault. The professional said it was her fault. Well, Narcotics Anonymous is telling me it's my fault, right? So it was for all those years that I was out there, in and out, in and out, in and out. Like I had people in the professional world enabling me to believe it was her fault. And I believe that was detrimental to me, and that's just my story, and you know, I'm not bashing the professionals. But for me, this unique story, it was detrimental. So I dove in this time, and for the first time in my life, I listened to you people. I worked the steps of Narcotics Anonymous. I accepted the fact that I had a disease. Okay. I accepted the fact that my mother had the disease. I accepted the fact that I needed to treat the disease. I surrendered to the fact that I couldn't do it alone and that it wasn't... That was really strange. and then in the second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I opened up to the belief that maybe, just maybe, this program could work for me. And the faith, the humility, and the hope came from that step. And then in the third step is trust. Like I need to get the acceptance in order to have the faith, in order to get the hope, in order to get to the trust in the third step. So this time clean, and I say that because I had history around here, like I didn't only owe amends to my family and society, I owed amends to you people. There were a lot of people in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous that I had to, you know, I did some, there's a girl in here today that I had made amends to for acting crazy in a recovery house. And I made direct amends to her. Like I wrote it down, I went and picked her up, and I told her I was sorry, and I never did it again. Like amends means change. And in this process of working the steps, I began to change. The transformation of who I was at 1 year clean to 21 years clean is completely apparent that the steps in Narcotics Anonymous work. And the third step, when I got the trust and things began to happen that I could not quite explain. In the fourth step, the accountability piece directly coincides with the eighth and ninth step. And the fourth step, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. When I jumped over that hurdle and was able to place the blame where it needed to go, I was able to rid myself of the resentments. That was the beginning of the spiritual principle of forgiveness. And in the fifth step, when I admitted to God, to another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs, I figured out where all that shit came from. And I was able to have the spiritual principle primarily of awareness in the sixth step. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, and I got a little overwhelmed with the all and entirely. Because I was like, oh my God, is like my whole character going to change? No. The sixth step says that until we have our foot in the grave, that we will always have the thought. It's what we do with it that will count. And it's the thought, the feeling, and the action. And if I work to change my thinking, then my feelings, and then the seventh step gives me the ability to, the impulsiveness slips away. It gives me the ability to think before I act. So I humbly ask him to remove the shortcoming before I act out on the defect, not call my sponsor after I got high, or call my sponsor after I hit somebody in the face, or call my sponsor after I cheat on my husband. You know, because my sponsor told me that once I had the knowledge of the seventh step that I was not allowed to hurt people anymore. I had the knowledge. I was able not to hurt people anymore. And am I still going to do it? Yeah, there's humanness in all of us. Seventh step, tenth step talks about it. But I have the ability not to. And then in the eighth step, I remember being in an eighth step meeting one time and somebody said, oh, it's just a list. I was like, what the fuck did you say? They talk about four, they talk about six. Let me tell you what, when I got to my eighth step, the first time through the steps, I was devastated when I was faced with the pain I caused others. First time I typed my eighth step and I put all my family members around me with like pictures. And as I typed it and looked into the eyes of them in the pictures, I could not stop crying. The whole time I shared it with my sponsor, I could not stop crying. Like four, I got that. Like I told everything I ever did bad and I just wanted to get it off my chest. And six, I knew the person drugs had made me and I wanted to change. I wanted to get to the point where I could humbly ask him to remove my shortcoming before I act out on the defect. I didn't want to be the person drugs made me anymore. I wanted to be the woman God intended me to be. And when I looked in the mirror, like, and I looked at the eighth step and I realized that my whole life had been pain towards others, there again I had that same feeling, like if my only purpose on this earth is to hurt people, I don't want to live here. And I got to work to do the ninth step. Like my sponsor told me, you don't have to jump on airplanes and go across the country and do this and do that. And I said, I made financial amends. And I started that early. Like, I've been around Narcotics Anonymous for 35 years. I have 21 years clean. I knew that I needed to pay people back some money, right? So I started early. I didn't wait till the ninth step. I went to people where I could make a direct amend, and I waited for them. Like, I waited to have some consistency in my life. The ninth step talks about the consistency. Like, you can't just get here and next week be like, I'm clean, I'm sorry. You know, it don't work like that. Like, for 15 or 20 or 30 years, we've been assholes. We have to give them, our families and society, a couple years to see us do the right thing. So, what are you doing?
So, your half an hour is in the stuff?
Okay. Thank you. So I really wanted to tell the Christmas story.
No, I know. Go ahead and tell.
Okay. Okay, so made amends to my mother, and I really want to tell this story, so I'm just going to tell that. I got on that plane where I said my sponsor said you didn't have to get on a plane and go, you know, I got on that plane and I went to Florida. And I sat down with my mom, and she had been in AA, and I'm in NA, but she knew what the amends process was. She just was never able to get herself back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made amends to her, direct amends in the hotel room, blah, blah, blah. I said to her, while we're here, why don't we go to Walt Disney World? And she was like, okay. And my mother was, you know, getting older, and she was on like one of them little buggies you had to push through, you know, what are they called, whatever. Not a wheelchair, but the buggies, you know. And we're walking around with her, and it's Christmas time. It was like around December, the second week in December, and the whole place is full of Christmas lights. And you know, I don't believe in coincidences. I have a relationship with my higher power that I know things happen that I can't quite explain. And this is one of those. We made the amends, And she made amends to me. And we walk out in the MGM studios, and there's this little girl standing on the stage, and it was the Osborne Christmas lights. And there's 2 million Christmas lights, and there's like this power grid. And they said, we want somebody from the audience to come up and turn the power grid on. And all these little kids were like, pick me, pick me, pick me. And me and my mom are standing there, and we're looking around because the lights are so beautiful, and we're remembering. We're both on the same page of like our memories of Christmas. That was the best memories that we ever had together, just those short 4 years of my life and my sister's life. And I know that she was thinking the same thing. And all these little kids are like, pick me, pick me, pick me. And so the princess comes down and picks this little girl up and puts her on the stage. And she's like, if you have the power of Christmas and you touch that thing and you pull it, all these lights are going to come on. For her. And, right. And this is totally throwing me off. But anyway, so they say to the little girl, they had the microphone too. They asked her what her name was. And this, for me, was the spiritual experience. The little girl had long brown hair, a beautiful little girl, and they said, what is your name? And she said, my name is Nikki. And she turned the lights on, and my mother and I looked at each other and just started crying. Because the spirit of Christmas was like the only good moments that my mother and I shared. And for that little girl's name to be my name just wasn't a coincidence. And my mother died in 2009 as a direct result of this disease. I was able to take care of her. I was able to pay for her funeral. I was able to love her for those 90 days that she had cancer, because it was really quick. Liver cancer. Hit it once with chemo, and she had a total liver failure. And but I was able to do that with dignity, without resentment, as a direct result of the program of Narcotics Anonymous and the 8th and 9th step. And I'm an addict. My name is Nikki. I'll keep coming.
Thanks, Nikki. That's just amazing. All right, so we have our second speaker. I'd like to introduce Jennifer. Hi, ladies. And Billy. It's all ladies here. Thank you, Nikki. That was amazing. I feel like we're just chilling, right? And there's like 10 of us here. What an awesome convention so far. I love seeing all the old people. You know, I feel like it's my age group. Love it. Never been to this one before, though. But I am grateful to be here and with my husband, Billy, and to share about steps 8 and 9. So, I mean, that story, Nikki, your experience, strength, and hope really touched me. I was crying about that last story. That's so cool. You know, I'm an addict, and for me that means, you know, I have a disease that tells me I don't have a disease. I have a disease that I feel like I've had since the day I was born, and I learned a lot about it in step one. You know, I didn't start working steps right away. It was in and out for a while. Consequences, you know, getting me there. But I can't talk about steps 8 and 9 without talking about learning about the disease of addiction, how long it took to actually work step one, and then, you know, beating around the bush to finally get to step one with a sponsor. And then understanding that there's three aspects of the disease of addiction, right? The physical, mental, and spiritual. Physical being, one is too many, 1,000 never enough, I can't stop using until I'm obliterated once I start. The mental aspect is that I'll choose to use even though I know it'll destroy my life. Even though I don't really want to, and I said I wasn't going to, but I get around it and I change my mind. And the spiritual aspect of my total self-centeredness, which is not to be confused with selfishness. You know, it's not being selfish so much. It may look like it at times, but not for everybody. Self-centeredness is like, I can't stop thinking about me and my life and my feelings. I can't stop thinking about my past and feeling it over and over and reanalyzing it, you know, and my future, what's going to happen, every possible scenario of what could happen, thinking about what you're thinking, that I'm thinking about you, you know, I just can't stop thinking, and the feelings that just come along with it. And that's a spiritual dilemma, because it's not built with any higher power in there. It's never positive. It's always like negative, and I got to figure it out. You know, it's me trying to figure out all these possibilities. What did she mean by that? What did he mean by that? What is he going to do? Versus God-centeredness, which is there's a higher power that I can lean on, I can turn to, that has a plan, that can figure it out. None of that stuff. You know, even though I believed in God, it just, he didn't work like that in my life, you know? And I didn't know that self-centeredness was something that you could be powerless over. You know, I thought it was a choice. I was a bad person. I was born wrong and bad. And I come from a family of earth people, in contrast, you know? No addicts in my family. Like, my dad is a Czechoslovakian immigrant. I have two older sisters who, you know, they might have smoked pot once, maybe. You know, it didn't stick. You know, just like, what? And there's me, who, ever since I can remember, has been feeding the void I didn't even know I had. You know, just doing whatever I felt like doing, whatever felt right. Even if it destroyed everything or I got in trouble, it's just what I felt like doing, and I felt like fun, and why didn't you do this too? You know, I don't know. And drugs just kind of fell into that circle and just made it like, yeah, this is exactly right. You know, I think my first drug of choice was food, you know, and then it was boys, and then it was drugs, you know, and getting high. I love getting high more than anything. It's like that abusive first boyfriend, you know. You never forget your first love, even if he was a dick, you know. And that, it was just going to be that, me and that feeling, you know. And it cuts us apart from, like, the social users, right? It's like that relationship with getting fucked up. And then coming to understand that, man, I can't live with it or without it, because I keep getting in trouble. I keep ending up in all these places, and I want to die, but I cannot live without them, because then I got to feel. And that was everything, right? I don't know how to feel. And if I know if I do feel, it's going to be all negative, so why even live? Right, so it was in desperation to do the first step. Ask some chick to be my sponsor, and then actually ask her to help me and sit down, even after treatment and all that other stuff, to actually do a first step with somebody and come to understand that spiritual aspect of the disease of addiction. I was like, oh my gosh, this is me all my life, right? And then having hope. And this convention means a lot to me, because talking about, you know, giving basic text to jails, and I know I got the message from the basic text, you know, and it didn't have a face or a drug of choice and didn't want to fuck me and all that stuff. It's just the truth about addiction and the feelings, and that's all that I felt was what was written down. So making that decision to not fight, to be all in just for today and surrender, just for today, to the management of my life, to Narcotics Anonymous, just for today, meant working the steps. And, you know, from that surrender of the first step and that little bit of hope that I felt something in that first step. I felt something that closely aligned to tripping, and which I loved a lot. And this was a real fucking feeling, right? That gave me hope. And then the second step of coming to believe is something can really help me, not just I wish you hope and I hope and please help me kind of stuff, but like I can go to a meeting and talk to somebody and I feel better, and they give me guidance, and it can restore me to sanity. You guys say you're getting better and you're doing better, and then making a decision just for today to turn my will and life over to that power, whatever it is that wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. What? Right? And like so happy, not just go be a nun and don't sleep around kind of happy, you know, God's will, but like the real I want you to be so happy from the heart. I was like, all right, that sounds cool. I believe in that. And doing that thorough four step, and then sharing it, and seeing my patterns, and then coming to the present with the step six of you know, being entirely ready, wanting that, wanting to have the things that I do to defend myself and fit in with the world that totally messed me all up. You know, my reactions to anger, resentment, and fear, and learning how to be willing to change it, get in position to have that change to acceptance, love, and faith, and then get on my knees and ask God to do what I can't, what the program can't, and what I'm struggling with, and remove that to be in a spiritually fit position to do a list of people that I harmed. And you know, I felt invisible a lot of my life, you know, with my family, and I really didn't think I hurt people that much, except for the obvious hurts like stealing, which I'd been doing before I ever got high. Stealing and lying, that's just the coping mechanism of my life. And my family was not like, you have a drug problem. They're just like, you are fucked up. You know, ever since you are. And I'm like, what? Okay. So it wasn't like anything new, but my list had to be complete, you know. And I think about it sometimes of what opportunities that earth people don't get to go back for as far as you can remember. And who do you not want to see in the grocery store? Who do you not want to run into? Who are you not prepared to see because of the feelings that it brings up? And I'm talking all the way from elementary school, from watching a girl get beat up and not doing anything about it, to being one of the people that teased somebody that eventually took their own life, for being the person that helped somebody get high for the first time. You know, all the people that I drunk, you know, driving under the influence, all those people that I put their lives at risk. For that little kid that was in the other room we were using in the house, that little kid that was in the crib, that was in diapers, that cried, and nobody would go the fuck in there. And that baby was crying, but we were getting fucking high. You know what I mean? I remember walking by that kid, I'm talking 2, maybe 18 months, to use the bathroom, catching their eye, that kid's eye, and being like, what the fuck is going on here? All those people, all the guys that I ever said, you're the one, all the guys that I fucked, and then would never claim that I did. Nope, I don't know you. You know, my mom, my dad, and all that stuff, and just being entirely, you know, willing. And I was entirely willing because I saw what my thorough work had done in the other steps, and I wanted more of what this program had to offer. So I was like super thorough, man. And then, you know, my sponsor being like, you cannot even think about step 9 because you will not do this if you do. And it's going to look totally different. 9 is going to look totally different from 8. And I believed her on that, and she was right. So when I got my list and I felt it was thorough, and I added people all the time as they just came up to my head, I'd be writing them on the list. Oh man, and the first step, 8-step, and the second 8-step, you know, was totally different. I've been in the program for a while, and all the people that I corrected because you broke a tradition, all the people that you can't say that word here, you know, and they never came back ever again, you know, adding them people to the list. And then step 9, you know, going through and being like, okay. And step working guy, which came out the second time around through the steps, you know, talks about the restitution, restoration, and resolution, you know, and putting people in like categories, like there's all the guys that fit in this big category, you know, and then there's a few guys that just stand out. There's all these girls I was horrible friends with, but then there's these couple situations that really do make me feel horrible. And then weeding them out and being like, okay, with my sponsor, you know, there's going to be direct amends, indirect amends. And for those that you have a direct amends, we're going to write a script so you don't go off. Because I naturally go and do some splaining with my amends. I know I really stole your shit. But I was all fucked up. I had the disease of addiction. Sorry. You know, like none of that stuff. You know, saying sorry to my sister. But we had a horrible mother, right? No, none of that stuff. It's like each person, if there was a direct amends, one, they didn't need to be announced. I'm doing my 9th step as part of my program. Couldn't say that. You know, I had to be like, hey, and it made it about you. You know, back then when I stole that stuff from you, I thought a lot about it over the years. And I've regretted it. And you deserve to be. I wish I was a better friend. And you deserve. You deserve good friends. And I'm sorry that we missed that time together. Right? So it's about them. And that's the script had to be written out of what I was going to say to make sure I didn't flip it back on. Not my fault. And it's all about me. Who cares about how you feel? Mom, you know, my sisters. I want to be a good sister to you. You deserve a sister that's honest. And I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you what that means to me. And so the indirect amends is like, what behaviors am I going to change? And some of them can be really creative. You know, all these things, we were really creative with the process. You know, whether that meant I sent a card every birthday, because all the birthdays that they sent me a card, right? And I just took the money and rolled. Never showed up to the family stuff. I send it, I show it, and I'm not telling them it's part of my 9th step. But this kid, right? I don't know that kid. I just remember his mom's name was Chicky, right? And that we used drugs with, and the baby's in the crib. I'm like, what am I going to do? And so the creativity was like, he might be in this meeting. And every kid that comes in, you treat it like Chicky's son. Treat him. Be good to him. Go up to him. Hug him. Welcome him. How can I help you in your recovery? Make sure nobody's taking advantage of him. You know, that's my indirect amends to Chicky's son. You know, so it's about positive action. You know, what am I doing today? I'm living my 9th step amends in a lot of areas, indirect, by just staying in the process of recovery. Right? There's a lot of things that says, well, if I wasn't getting high, it wouldn't happen. Like all those people that I put at risk driving down the road. So today I'm in recovery, and I know that in order for me to stay in recovery and not use, I have to be all in. Right? I have to be all into the program today. Even 31 years later, I'm all in because I'm still doing my indirect amends. And for those people that, you know, in the meetings where I shut down, shut out, didn't show up for, you know, I make my indirect amends through my behaviors today. And you know, for some of the dudes that were like, you ever had a dude on the side burner? You know, you always know he's always there. He's not good enough for the front burner. But he's always on the side, back burner, you know, when it's in between. That guy, it's always there. You know, letting that go and not ever involving that person again in my... And if I see him, be kind and generous and acknowledge his existence as a human being. I gave myself amends for all those guys that I, you know, did stuff with under the influence that grossed me out, right? I gave myself amends by, when I see them, I smile at them. I'm not trying to get nothing there, you know, I'm not claiming nothing, but I acknowledge their existence as a human being, because gosh, they got that unique pleasure of being with me once. It'll never happen again. But if I honor them, I'm honoring myself. You know, let's say I'm worth something. That you are worth something because you were with me at once. And I wish good things on you. You are one of the special ones. You know, and that, it frees me up to not worry about who I'm going to run into, what am I going to say, and having the script. So after 9th step, you know, I had like everything still on a card that I had in my purse. And if I saw them, because anybody, I didn't go out and see the people that I used with, but I should be prepared if they come into the rooms to know that my amends, this is my moment, right? And if I forget, I have my card, I flip it out. I'm like, oh yeah, my side of the street. What am I to say to this person and to welcome them? What are the indirect amends? And it's a lot about love and respect. You know, an action, right? Love is an action word. And the beautiful thing that recovery taught me and continues to teach me is that it doesn't matter what I think or feel, as long as my actions and words are spiritual, my life becomes spiritual. I think we learn about that first when we find out I can feel like using and not get high, right? Remember that miraculous moment when I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like getting high and I didn't. And my life was not destroyed as a result, even though I really felt like getting high. And these spiritual principles are a lot like that. Like I can feel some anger, resentment, jealousy, insecurity, but if my words and my deeds reflect the spiritual principles that I'm trying to practice, my life is not destroyed by my feelings. And see, that's such a reversal for this addict. Everything was about how I felt. And I really expected you to judge me by my intentions, not by my actions. So I could say to my man, I know I didn't show up last night, but I love you, right? You know I love you, right? My mom, my sisters, you know I love you. I know I stole from you, but I love you and you know that. And I expected them to act according to what my intentions were. And today in recovery, that's reversed. I love you, I show you. When I have a conversation with you, like you were talking about that intention listening, right? With my children, it's like, my love is like in everything. It's like looking them in the eye and sitting down and being like, tell me about how that Roku, Pokemon hurt your thing. Wow, that's so interesting. You know, that's so cool. And because they don't know what I'm thinking and feeling. If I don't see it and show it. And it's such a reversal from the earth people world. The earth people world self-help books is like, tell everyone how you feel. Well, some of my feelings are not facts. Some of my feelings are sick. And they're not what I want to live like, right? Like in the beginning, it's like, I feel this way. It must be right for me. And then to come find out in the first step that my feelings, I want all that you have. I want all the tension on me. I want to be rich and famous without the price that comes along with it. I want to feel in ecstasy all the time. And if you, as my partner, do not make me feel that way, then I'm getting a new partner because something's wrong with you. These are the kinds of things that I felt with as a self-centered person that was not a choice, y'all. Not a choice. Powerless over the big hole inside of my soul that I just expected other people and things to fill. And I think that's why that first step is so crucial to understand the nature of the disease is not the drug. It's my attitude, my feelings, and my spiritual conditions underneath it. Which is why I can be just as sick in recovery as I ever was out there. You know? That's a whole nother workshop, right? But the cool thing is that we still have the ability to change our whole lives right here, right now. I don't have to get high to make a decision that I'm going to change everything about my life from here on out, right? And I've done that a few times, you know? But I'm really glad to be here with you guys, and thanks for letting me share.
All right, I want to thank Nikki and Jennifer for a very good meeting and everyone else that shared. And then